Welcome to Bible Study for Progressives, a show where moderates, liberals, and leftists of all faiths and ideologies come together to discuss scripture, spirituality, and politics. Today's show is The Worker, the Immigrant, and the Refugee, the Good Samaritan in Contemporary Context. I will read from the Gospel of Luke, the story of the Good Samaritan, and then apply its lessons to the problems of the world. Along the way, I will share with you some of my experience working in social justice advocacy. Our panel will add their views about that and about the tragedy in Dallas where 5 police officers were killed, as well as the continuing murder of black people by police officers across the country. The story of the Good Samaritan guides us as we respond to yet another gun-related tragedy. Though organizing can be difficult and even impossible at times, it takes courage to fight back. Shootings and murders shouldn't happen anywhere, and our protest should be places of nonviolence. It's up to us to get involved and keep the movement out of the hands of the haters. And it's up to the leaders of our movements to disassociate from those who advocate violence. Our panel today includes commentators Greg Ronning, pastor at The Table, an alternative progressive church in Santa Ana. My ministry partner, Jeanesse Spirit Walker James, our regular commentator, Professor David Westfall, Dixie Matheson, founder of Worldwide Friends, an international student ministry at the University of Southern California, and my mother. Welcome, Mom. And
thank you.
And Faith Melissa, student, Biola University. Welcome, everyone. My name is Rich Procida, and I write modern lectionaries at blogs. I write at modern lectionaries at modernlectionaries.blogspot.com. Let's begin. Just then, a lawyer stood up to test Jesus. "Teacher," he said, "what must I do to inherit eternal life?" He said to him, "What is written in the law? What do you read there?" He answered, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself." And he said to him, "You have given the right answer. Do this, and you will live." But wanting to justify himself, he asked Jesus, "Who is my neighbor?" Jesus replied, "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell into the hands of robbers, who stripped him, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. Now by chance, a priest was going down that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. So likewise, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed on by the other side. But a Samaritan, while traveling near him, and when he saw him, he was moved with pity. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, having poured oil and wine on them. Then he put him on his own animal, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day, he took out 2 denarii, gave them to the innkeeper, and said, 'Take care of him, and when I come back, I will repay you whatever more you spend. Which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers? He said, "The one who showed him mercy." Jesus said to him, "Go and do likewise." The worker, the immigrant, and the refugee. The Good Samaritan in Contemporary Context by Rich Proceda. It would not have surprised those listening to Jesus that the priest and the Levite failed to aid the half-dead man. Priests were Sadducees, and the Sadducees were a religious political party. The Levites were members of the priestly class. They served the Sadducees. Both were members of Israel's elite. Many first century Jews scorned them for collaborating with the empire. That a politician and a rich man would refuse to help the needy is no surprise to anyone at any time. The greed of the rich with the complicity of politicians is well known. For this reason, the story of the Good Samaritan still speaks to us today. The story is in response to a question posed by a scholar of the law. Who are the neighbors we are to love as ourselves? The lawyer takes the part on loving God from Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 5, and the commandment to love your neighbor from Leviticus chapter 19, verse 18. Then he combines them and comes up with the great commandment. In Luke, it is the lawyer who speaks the great commandment. Mark and Matthew instead have the words come from Jesus. Matthew's version presents the story as a conflict between the Pharisees and Jesus, but Mark only says that the lawyer noticed that Jesus had given a good answer. In Luke, the lawyer gives the right answer. Many commentators act as if the lawyer had done something wrong by testing Jesus. But there is little conflict between the lawyer and Jesus in Luke's version. The lawyer attempts to justify himself by asking a follow-up question. Perhaps he felt the first question too easy, so he raised the prickly issue of who qualifies as a neighbor who we must love as ourselves. Deuteronomy 6 defines a neighbor as a member of the tribe of Israel or a resident alien. Yet Moses commanded that we love the stranger because Jews had been strangers in the land of Egypt. Still, most people in the first century understood a neighbor to be limited to members of one's own nation. Jesus turns the question around. A neighbor is one who acts as a neighbor. The commandment to love our neighbors extends even to our enemies. Jews and Samaritans hated one another. Neither would set foot in the other's territory. Yet the Samaritan is the hero of our story. The story begins with a man lying, dying, on the side of a road. He had been robbed, beaten, and left half dead. We don't know who he was. We are only told he was attacked by robbers. They brutally beat him, took everything he had, and left him to die. They didn't care whether he survived. His life didn't matter. Like the beating and murder of black and brown people by the police and Border Patrol agents, assailants like these act with impunity. They beat and kill because they are violent, corrupt, and racist. Prosecutors and judges favor them because they are often racist themselves. or are pressured by the code of silence among cops. We are all enmeshed in a culture that values wealth, power, and status over human life. The robbers in the story could also represent employers who refuse to pay a livable wage. The rich demand cuts in basic government services and then rob us again through tax cuts and bailouts. Wealthy corporations spend billions to influence our politicians, buy our elections, and lobby for policies favorable to the corporate elite. In Citizens United, the Supreme Court ruled that corporations are persons with the same citizenship rights as individual human beings. By comparison, in 1857, the Supreme Court held that people of African descent, whether free or slave, could never become citizens of the United States. Since most people cannot compete with wealthy corporations, the court has again diminished the rights of human beings and granted the rich and powerful undue influence over our government and its policies. In a total upending of morality, the powers have divided the world into the undeserving poor and the deserving rich. According to the last census, wages have been stagnant for years. Between 2007 and 2012, for example, the income of the 1% rose over 31%, while the incomes of the 99% remained flat. The top 10% own half of our nation's wealth, while 1 in 6 Americans, some 50 million people, struggle to put food on the table. Half of all Americans are poor or low income. The working poor is a growing segment of the U.S. population. By 2012, half of all full-time jobs paid less than $34,000 a year, and a quarter of all Americans work for $10 an hour or less. Like the man left dying on the side of the road, half of all Americans are being beaten to death by low wages, a rigged economy, and a corrupt political system. So our story continues. By chance, a politician came by and, seeing the man lying half dead, passed him by, leaving him to die. Maybe the dying man was a refugee or immigrant. Better he die, the politician thought. One less immigrant to march across the border, one less Muslim to ban. Today, there is a call to build a wall between us and our neighbors to the south. This is a feature of the domination system, where people are imprisoned behind borders, then imprisoned in prison, placed in solitary confinement, and oftentimes killed. In a world of empires, borders can serve just as much to keep people in as they serve to keep people out. Behind these prison walls, we call borders, is incredible violence. Foreign powers overthrow democratically elected governments and then beat, torture, and assassinate those who resist. Like Bertha Cáceres, an activist recently assassinated by her own government, a government that overthrew the democratically elected president of Honduras with the support of the United States. Behind these prison walls we call borders are governments that rain down bombs on their own people with the assistance of foreign powers, like Russia in Syria and Saudi Arabia in Yemen. The United States provides the Saudis with weapons and stands by while the people of Yemen are slaughtered and the hope of democracy in Bahrain is crushed. Behind these prison walls we call borders is poverty and corruption, hopelessness and despair. People, even children, take incredible risks to flee from violence, poverty, and war, and to make a better life for themselves and their families. But the politician sees them as political fodder, as a way to tap into the demons of hatred, fear, and anger in order to rally support for his candidacy, to gain access to power, and to enrich himself at the people's expense. Let's continue with our story. After the politician came a rich man, a member of the 1%. He too, when he came upon the man lying on the side of the road, passed on by. The life of the dying man didn't matter to him. Perhaps he thought the man expendable, another slave or laborer to be exploited and discarded. Perhaps he thought it would cost too much to provide the man with health care, clothing, food, and shelter. Perhaps he thought it not his responsibility to care for the needy. Finally came an immigrant, a refugee from a war-torn country, the one on the other side of that wall. And he took the man, bandaged his wounds, and provided him with nourishment and shelter. Then the question is asked, which of these three men was a neighbor to that naked, half-dead man? Which one loved his neighbor as himself? The one who showed him mercy, answered the lawyer. Then go do likewise, Jesus said. Provide the hungry with food, the needy with resources, the homeless with shelter, and the afflicted with care. Much of the above was part of a speech I gave on May 1st, 2016 at Memorial Park in Santa Ana, California. The Orange County May Day Coalition had invited me to speak. Though I got cut off near the end of my speech, a videographer asked me to finish it during the march. By this media, I stood to reach thousands more. The protesters were demanding fair wages and immigration reform. I carried the Syrian flag in support of the Syrian people and all refugees throughout the world. I felt filled with the spirit, and I even had mystical experiences. I gave the last part of my speech during the march. At one point, I felt my spirit rush out of me and into the face of a marcher walking across my path. I'd imagine she may have rejected my message because I'm a middle-aged white male Christian, and refusing to even hear it made a point of walking away. I suddenly felt my spirit rush down low along the ground and then swoop up into her face. In my vision, I saw her move away in shock. My other mystical experience that day occurred after the march, when a group of Native Americans began a sacred ritual. A woman, dancing low to the ground, carrying a pot of burning sage, passed in front of me. Again, I felt my spirit crouch down and rush forward low to the ground and up into her face. In my vision, my spirit surprised her and caused her to pull back in shock. Then I felt my spirit stretch out and pour some of my energy, my chi or ki, into the pot. As my spirit withdrew, it felt as if I had taken something from the smudging pot. When my spirit returned, I had a vision of being in a dimly lit wilderness, and I felt the sacred mystical energy of nature, what Native Americans call the Great Spirit. Though things didn't go perfectly, I felt so filled with the spirit that nothing could ruin my day. I had my mother with me, and I hadn't told her or any of the brave members of my church who attended the march with me that the situation was politically delicate. As someone who works to get churches involved in social justice, I meet resistance on both ends. Many progressives don't like Christians. Others fear the combination of religion and politics. There are also extremist elements who do not welcome the inclusion of certain types of people. Religious liberals are skittish about getting involved. But all of this again reminds me of the Good Samaritan. We cannot simply walk by. No matter how hard it is to do social justice work, Christians must do more than simply talk about it. when we finally begin to do justice, when we finally begin to organize, when we finally get involved because of our faith rather than in spite of it, we might find that Spirit has our back. We must stand with our neighbors, the immigrant, the worker, and the refugee. If we are to love them as ourselves, we cannot simply pass by while they suffer and die. Paul reminds us to test everything. Hold fast to what is good. The lawyer did nothing wrong in testing Jesus. Instead, he came up with the right answer. The great commandment to love God with all our hearts and our neighbors as ourselves. Asking what this means, to love our neighbors as ourselves, is not an offense. It is instead true discipleship. What it means today is the same as it meant then. To stand with the poor, the marginalized, and the outcast. Today, these include the worker, the immigrant, and the refugee. At the practical level, it means to organize, to get involved, not just individually, but collectively as Christians. For we are to be the light of the world and the salt of the earth, so that others may see our good works and give glory to God. It's time we take our light out from under the bushel and put it to work. This means we must do more than individual acts of charity. We must stand up for justice, even in the face of persecution. We must become willing to take risk for the kingdom of God. As John of Patmos, speaking on behalf of Jesus, wrote in the book of Revelation, "I know your works. You are neither cold nor hot. I wish that you were either cold or hot. So because you are lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I'm about to spit you out of my mouth. For you say, I am rich, I have prospered, I need nothing. You do not realize that you are wretched, pitiable, poor, blind, and naked. To love one's neighbors as ourselves means to understand that we and our neighbors are one." Martin Luther King Jr. put it most elegantly in his letter from a Birmingham jail. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. And the prophet Micah proclaimed, "He has told you, O mortal, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God?" Are we ready to do justice, to love our neighbors as ourselves, to follow Jesus to the cross to prepare for the coming kingdom of God? Are we ready to be the salt of the earth and a light to the nations so that God's salvation may reach the ends of the earth? As the author of 1 Peter wrote, "For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example, so that you should follow in his footsteps." In other words, go do likewise. Now let's turn to our discussion. So a couple of you were at the event. What did you think of the event that I've sort of referenced in there? Pastor Ronan?
Well, we were excited to attend the event for a couple of reasons. One, the call to love your neighbor. Sometimes the institutional churches or churches of privilege will go in thinking they know what their neighbor needs. And so for us, it was an opportunity to show up and to listen and to experience our neighbor, to kind of enter into a through humility, not thinking we had the answer. But you can't begin to love your neighbor until you know your neighbor. And so our chief goal at that event was to go into the neighborhood where our church is located and to listen. I think sometimes we want to do action before we speak, before we listen. And so for us, it was a time of deep listening and to take in all the different people that gathered in. and was surprised by the very different groups of people that gathered together, and the unity that we discovered in being neighbors with each other and experiencing each other, and so the conversations and just a lot of listening. So for us, it was a really neat opportunity to listen and to hear what the issues are. You know, I think we think, especially in your position of white privilege, we think we know it all. And so our place was to let go of the things we thought we knew and to experience what our neighbors really, what the issues were to them. And it was also interesting to be someplace where the language wasn't English. And so we sat there, and a lot of times we were listening, but we didn't know what they were saying, but we were still taking in an experience. And even the experience of not knowing the language was teaching us something about what it means to be a good neighbor.
Yeah. And I've been to a lot of their events, and I was happy to get the opportunity to speak, mm-hmm. but I knew that, you know, at any point something could go wrong, and I sort of anticipated that. And so I knew what I was going to do and what was going to happen, kind of. I knew somebody would ask me to do it on the march, because mm-hmm. somebody always has a camera mm-hmm. nowadays, and, you know, if I didn't get to finish, somebody's going to ask me. So that worked out well.
The biggest shock for me is I've done a lot of marches where the organizers talk to the police and you plan it out. And as we began this march, it became real clear that we were taking over the streets. No one had asked the police ahead of time. And so for white privilege, it was like, what do you mean this isn't an escorted march? Yeah. It was a contained march. The police, I thought, actually did a very, very good job of containing the march and not being, not instigating any trouble at all. But it was a really different place to be in, where more edgy than I had anticipated.
Yeah, I think this group told me that they don't like to tell the police where they're going, because then the police swarm them. Mm-hmm. So, and then the police, that was in Santa Ana. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the police rhetoric has been pretty harsh, calling these people criminals, advocating for the rights of criminals so that they continue their criminal activity. That was coming out a bit. So there is a sense of a conflict, especially with police brutality, between some of the groups and others.
And this crowd was families. It wasn't, there were some hooligans,
yeah.
but it was mostly families, and yeah. it was a very positive experience.
Yeah, children are at these marches. Yeah. So when we think about Dallas, we think about the shooting, we think that there are children at these marches too.
Yeah.
And they should be family type events. That's what I sort of think. What did you think about the event, Mom?
Well, it was fun to see the Native Americans dancing. And when you think of, they're the epitome of injustice, because we stole their land from them.
Right.
And very badly. So it was good to see them participating.
Good. What did you think about my mystical experiences?
I didn't know about it. You didn't tell me.
I didn't tell you. But you read about it, right?
Well, I heard it just now. I didn't
Oh, so you didn't read the whole article.
I guess not.
Well, I think one of those things, while some people can think they're supernatural and other people might not, they're perfectly plausible. We have pictures that sort of flash in our minds sometimes, a song that keeps coming back, or, you know, and sometimes you can get images that flash in your mind. And whether you think it's supernatural, it's certainly not something that's implausible from a human experience of being able to experience that type of a vision, and many of the mystics throughout time have experienced them too. But that's another issue. What did you think about them, Pastor Ronnie?
I don't come from a mystical background. I don't discount that, but I don't have much experience there. So much of my background in the Lutheran Church was finding God in the everyday and the common. So I think one of the things that we lack kind of our tradition was the mystical tradition. So I don't discount it, but it's not something I'm familiar with.
Yeah. What about you, Janice? You spirit walker?
Well, I've had a share of my own mystical experiences, quite many actually. So for me, that seems like something that is not only common to me, but also, like Pastor Greg said, I definitely believe that it happened. I always try to analyze any experience to find out, like you would a dream, the symbolism, what does it mean? You said your spirit flew downwards and then up, sort of rushed into the face of both women, it sounds like. Yes. So I would try to find out what that means, what exactly does that experience mean?
Yeah. I think one of the things that it means is that there seems to be a group within that group, which is more hooliganish, let's say, more negative about, you know, the participation of white people, more angry, or, you know, and like the warrior group in the native group, like there's the warrior group,
mm-hmm.
and then there's the spiritual leaders and the elders. I happen to know one of the elders, at least superficially, and then the woman, I believe, carrying the pot would have been an elder as well. And the fact that I put my kai or my spirit into the pot and took some of the spirit out sort of represents me being like avatar, or accepted into the community, or accepted spiritually, or something like that.
Well, you also said that you, in the vision, that you found that they were shocked by it, like surprised. So this actually goes back to another Samaritan story that reminds me of the Samaritan, the woman at the well. Because when Jesus approached her, she was quite surprised that a Jewish man would speak to a Samaritan woman, such as herself, in broad daylight, being a woman, being a Samaritan. And that, that I think, was shocking to her, that, you know, I think she even says, why are you speaking to me? You know, you're Jewish, I'm Samaritan, you know. It's that sort of encounter where not only is it an encounter for us with our neighbor, but also for that other person encountering maybe someone that they wouldn't normally see as an ally or a neighbor, and maybe that's surprising to them as much as it is to us to have those encounters with each other.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, so.
What do you think about these type of visionary experiences?
I'm a type of person who's very, very left brain, okay?
Yeah.
I get my mystical experiences vicariously, okay? when you really see it, if you look through it, think books like the Revelation or Zechariah, you see all kinds of visions there. So, I mean, again, I haven't really had any kind of visions, but there are plenty of them I can see here that other people have had, which are very, very interesting.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Faith? Have you experienced any supernatural experiences?
Well, sure, yeah. I've had maybe not quite as many as Janessa, I think, maybe.
We've actually talked about this quite recently, actually.
We can call it the supernatural, yes. Though sometimes I'm not even sure if we should call it the supernatural or if it just is the natural that we are just not accessing, you know,
right.
And that, and maybe some of us are born with sort of a more robust sensory apparatus for this, you know, quote unquote supernatural world. And maybe to a degree we can all sort of develop that. We can all become more open to that and more acute in our perceptions. But I think in some ways it is very natural, like you spoke about, you know, feeling more connected and sending your spirit or your energy out. And I do think this can be kind of very scary terminology in the Christian world, like when you talk about energy and that sort of thing. It almost seems to be mutually exclusive to God. But I don't really think it has to be that way. I do think, you know, fundamentally we're all made of energy, and this whole planet is made of energy. This existence, this whole universe is made of energy. And that does unite us. So to me, that you would have this experience just seems like, on one hand, yeah, we can call it mystical, but it also just seems like, of course. Like,
seems so natural.
Like, it seems like it would be natural for you to have this experience, and that I think that for me, the more I open myself up to those mystical experiences, if we want to call them that, the more interesting life is to me, the more connected I feel to you talk about nature, the more connected I feel to nature, the more connected I feel to other people. And I think when we talk about social justice issues, loving your neighbor, when we talk about boundary dissolution, that really understanding that oneness of ourselves with nature and the rest of humanity, that's so important, you know, that I think, like, as Christians, sometimes we want to say, you know, we want to emphasize God as the other, and we want to emphasize ourselves as different from nature and different from other religions and different from God, and there's all these, like, distinctions being made, and that's not to say that those distinctions don't exist at all, but sometimes in the effort to establish those distinctions, we forget our connectivity with everything else, and that God has established that even in physics. He's established that even in our energy. So
I actually was gonna take off that because it reminds me of to say what is a defining feature of a Christian mystical experience, and I feel like that is the experience of unity, and I feel like that's very relevant to how we. Like you were saying, how do we engage with social justice issues as Christians? And I think we have to keep in mind that it is very important how we engage. And if we lose our essential experience of unity, we can engage in it in a very destructive way. And so I think we have to remember that we are one with God, and there's a union first with God, and then a union where, as Christians, you know, of all colors at this point, you know, Christianity has spread so much throughout the world that we're united by many things. We're united to other nations. We're united to other races. The Christian body makes up Black, White, Asian, I mean, Mexico, you name it, all these other countries are all part of the larger body. So if we remember that we are literally one body with everyone, we have more of this feeling of unity, then I think, yes, like, we can be in solidarity with the suffering because it's happening to our own, literally our own body, in that mystical Christian sense that one part of the body is suffering. If one part of it is suffering, we're all suffering. But the question is, sometimes I think that what I've seen with social justice, especially in liberal, very far left circles, is a very divisive sense that you know, whites are this way, Blacks are this way. Often whites are painted as the ultimate evil, the ultimate bad guy, right? And I think that's also a very destructive way to engage, and it loses that sense of unity that ultimately, you know, leaders like Martin Luther King had dreamed of, an America where we would experience that unity. I think he deeply felt that.
One thing about the supernatural is that you do as you practice it. Like, I practice tarot card readings, and I go to classes, practice mediumship development. You have more experience. I did ghost investigations, had experiences. So on the classification, I guess there's a philosophy, I guess, called naturalism, right? And that precludes anything that is defined as supernatural. So we're really, when we reference supernatural, there would be a clear distinction between naturalism and supernatural.
And I get that on a philosophical level. I guess I'm just bringing in my own understanding here. In my mind, yeah, so not everybody's privy to the contents of my mind.
We forget, I think.
But in my mind, that distinction is something that we impose, you know, from our perspective, from years and years of modernism and training to see the world a certain way. And for, like, ease of conversation, sure, it's helpful to use those words, but I think, like, and this is more recent in my thinking, but more recently in my thinking, I've come to see those experiences as just more part of an extension of the natural world. But we kind of are not trained to think of it that way. So we do need to say supernatural just because.
Well, Rich and I have talked about how, you know, there's a difference in theologically identifying as a supernaturalist versus a naturalist. And many religious people on the left have kind of disassociated from the supernatural. And I've even talked to a lot of, pastors and priests who, you know, when you bring up the fact that Jesus exorcised demons and that, you know, Jesus himself believed in a demonic unseen world, it said, oh, those people were just mentally ill. You know, he was really exercising something like schizophrenia. And I think that kind of, it sort of brushes over the fact that maybe there is this unseen world, both light and dark. It's not just all, you know, fairies and light. At least in some of my experiences, my own mystical experiences, some of them have been light, but also many of them have been encounters with those darker forces that we can't see. To the point where I am convinced that they exist.
And the example, when you mentioned that that sometimes there's sort of reverse, I guess you call it reverse racism or whatever you want to call it, where people just really don't like white people, don't like Christians. Do you have an example of that you're willing to share?
Well, an example of, you know, this is another thing that, you know, if you're white, you're going to get in trouble for saying something like reverse racism. Just are. You just, it's not technically allowed in those kinds of circles. And I don't know if I can have specific examples, but I will say I've had friends who are mixed race, who are half black, half white. Mm-hmm. And, from what they've shared of their own experiences with me, they're sort of interesting people to learn from, actually, because they're getting it from both sides. They're experiencing racism from the black side because they're not black enough, and from the white side because they're not white enough. So I think they're kind of they're in between worlds in a sense. So I think, you know, friends of mine have experienced that type of racism, but I think there's many examples of that.
Right, there's a current thing among the movements that if you're white, you shouldn't say anything.
You should just keep shut up and keep quiet. Yes, and I've been silenced many times. The funny thing is, I've been silenced actually mostly by other white liberals, right, who have basically. They've taken these, they've internalized it. And so now they want to educate other white people to also shut up, because it's like you're not allowed to say anything because you're the bad guy. You're the evil one. Even if you've done nothing wrong, even if you had nothing to do, I mean, this idea of this sort of inherited guilt over the centuries, like we're responsible for every single thing our ancestors ever did.
I agree with you, but at the same time, I think we can't underestimate that we need to shut up. I'm a white male, and there is a white privilege, and there's so much that we don't know. So I really think there's some wisdom in really being much better listeners. Also, just talking about racism, sometimes it's hard to define racism, but racism is prejudice plus power. So that sometimes you really can't be reverse racism if you don't have power. That can be prejudice. But racism is really that when you have power and prejudice together. I just find that a helpful distinction when talking about racism. And in that case, you know, it's a white, the white has the power. And so it's really hard to be a black racist if you don't have any power. You can be prejudiced. The classic definition of racism, I guess I always understood it as prejudice plus power.
Right, and I don't really want to make it too much about that, because obviously we have a lot of racism in the systemic racism in the police department, in which, I guess in all forms of patriarchy, when you're given power, and people seek it to abuse it. And the system, over the last 20, 30 years, we've been losing rights. I think that has something to do with this problem, that the conservative Supreme Court over the years has cut back our rights. Even the Miranda warning doesn't necessarily have to be given to people, and we think it is. And so the result is these rules on use of force are less stringent. I was thinking, this murder in Dallas, this is just a result of open carry. I wouldn't want to be a police officer in any state that has open carry. And I'm surprised that the police unions have not really come up and said, we don't want to have these people carrying guns in our streets.
It was this thing in Dallas, it was a gun, you know, handgun, or it was a rifle?
I think it was a sniper rifle, yeah. Right? Long rifle, sniper rifle.
I was just going to add to the what Pastor Greg was saying. I don't want my comment to be misconstrued as I don't think we need to listen, because I do think we definitely need to listen. But I don't think that listening has to go as far as to accept everything that we're told as a fact. And I think that's the distinction, I think, that I was trying to make, is that listening is the best thing you can do. But not to the exclusion of your own reason and your own ability to sort through facts. And there's a lot of propaganda out there on all sides. And so when you shut that part of your brain off and you start to listen without using that part of your brain, you're going to fall prey to that, those types of ways of thinking without actually reasoning and using facts. And that's the kind of thing that I'm against.
Yeah, and I think listening has to lead to a dialogue.
It has to, yes, and not just people speaking at each other and right. saying, you know, this is the way that you need to believe because this is the right answer about whatever that thing is. And I do agree there is, yes, racism plus power. This is a bad, horrible combination throughout the centuries. But I also think that there have been white people who have suffered too. Like, for instance, my grandmother was very poor. She picked cotton when she came to California. So I think in some ways there can be an intersection between experiences, no matter what race you have, because suffering is not exclusive to any one people's. I think almost every person, every race on this planet has suffered at one point at the hands of another race.
Yeah, and that's why I think the larger issue here is those who possess power abusing those who don't. That
no matter
I think
what
that's
race
the
they
meta
are.
Issue.
Yes.
And I think that as we evolve more and more as human beings, that actually, I wouldn't be surprised if at some point our conflict sort of evolves out of this race against that race and more, you know, the haves against the have-nots, and that being more defined in terms of just wealth and power and among mixed, you know, groups within those haves and have-nots.
And you see these.
That's already happening to a degree now, right? You know.
Well, and you see these. If you ask people from other countries, you know, who's like we're talking about, who's my neighbor? If you ask that in America, we have a certain thought pattern, or you know, our racism is mostly defined by, you know, people of color versus white people, or whatever our racial context is. But if you ask someone else, like I have friends from Iran, from Turkey. And there's racism of Persian people against Turkish people, of, you know, in Asian cultures, you know, you have a lot of that going on between the whole Asian continents, the Japanese against Chinese. And
Koreans.
So every culture defines who is and isn't their neighbor in their own context.
I think the role of fear in all this, you were saying the fear of the other. I mean, that's what really is also the fear is the really big issue out there too.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's use this event as an example. I've been going to these group May Day marches for years, actually, sometimes in downtown Los Angeles. I think I went to the last two in Santa Ana. You know, I've been hearing these people speak all the time, you know, and it's really not, when somebody says, oh, if you're white, you should just shut up, you know, it's really not very conducive to an artist who wants to have a voice, right? If you want to speak your voice, you know, really you should be allying with me because I'm on your side, you know, and that's where the distinction really falls, the boundary really falls there. Are we saying white people should just shut up? Is that what we're saying to our allies, just shut up? You know, but on the other hand, yeah, so I think there's extremism in these movements. Are you familiar with them at all, Dave?
I think human beings have a natural tendency to a lot of things. Okay, this whole thing about the other has been, you know, something that's been with us all throughout human history. And if you look at it 10,000 years ago, maybe, you know, it was really people were competing with each other, and, you know, and kind of like a zero-sum game, where if you share with somebody else, you're going to lose, okay? And so you've got that thing. You know, one of the things about the modern world, actually, is that in a sense, the pie has been expanding. If you have technological progress, it makes it possible for there to be more for everybody. But then this also implies that you need to have a certain level of cooperation, mm-hmm. Okay? You know, it's like, are we going to cooperate on the basis of having wars? Are we going to go out and cooperate on the basis of, you know, our economy produces and their economy produces and we have trade going in between, okay? Mm-hmm. And you'd like to think it's moving in that direction, because a bigger pie really does mean that there's more for everybody.
I remember, and I say this over and over again, it's just somebody at a speech at Long Beach State College when I was a feminist activist on pornography, she said, what we need is more speech, not less speech. Mm-hmm. So we have on these movements, there's an extremist part of them, and they seem, I think, to control the movements because they might be the one running them, or they might be the ones who are bringing people there. And I think we need to start bringing people there. Go ahead, Dave.
Basically, power operates on a lot of different levels, okay? You can have power operating at a very high level, one group being more above and another group down being more below, but you also have an awful lot of power going on just in individual situations, okay? And a church, for example, okay? Some people in that particular church are more influential, and they know it, and other people in the church know it, and if that leadership type thing gets threatened, sometimes it doesn't get real pretty.
So how should we respond to this tragedy in Dallas and the killing of black and brown people across the country by police, Pastor Ronnie?
I'm going to go back to something Janessa said, and our presiding bishop said, until we start to realize that the death to someone of color is a death to everybody, unless we realize your image about the body, mm-hmm. we have to come to this realization that we're the same body, until we can mourn like it's our community.
Yeah, or even our own self.
Mm-hmm. I'd go that far. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, it's so distant sometimes, and I think that's where I think maybe finding that oneness, I think, is really important. So I like that, and I think until we experience it as a personal loss, we're not going to do anything about it. And we were talking this morning at the table. Everyone now, you know, you post on Facebook and feel like you've made a difference in the world, but you haven't done anything. you have your moment of indigenous righteousness, and then you're done.
Yeah.
You haven't suffered a personal loss yet, and you can't suffer a personal loss until they're your neighbor. They can't be your neighbor until you get out and be with them and find out who they are.
That's one of the things I found going to these police brutality marches, is that they are for the families. That the families are often there, they're allowed to speak, and you go out there and meet them, and then you're directly supporting those people. And also, you're sort of, I think that as Christians, we need to get involved in these issues so that we can be a positive force for change in these movements, because a lot of these movements, they raise a lot of big issues, you know, like Black Lives Matter, put that issue all the way up there on top. You know, the environmental movement is making statements, you know. So I think we need to be out there to participate in the community in a way that is where we can heal the wounds.
To help the healers.
Yeah.
And like you were talking about that fringe element that's, I don't know if I want to say infiltrating. I mean, it happened with Occupy. You had a violent fringe that tried to start trouble. And I think that's the issue, like, what's your name again?
Dave,
yeah. What Dave was saying about how power, I mean, any, even in righteous movements where you have a just cause, it can be very easily taken over by people who just want to have power. I mean, this is what happened with communists, who originally thought they were going to help the proletariat, the underclass, and it turned into a very nightmarish experience for everyone involved. Millions died because of people in power, corrupt people in power, again, that rise out of these movements. And I think that goes back to seeing this as an issue with, we also have personal sin. You know, everyone has to deal with who they are and how they're going to confront issues in a healthy way.
Go ahead, Dave.
I've got an idea here, okay, and I've been thinking about this thing for a long time. And what I'd like to see is every church in the country and every synagogue in the country and every mosque in the country have at least one sermon a year just on the idea that we are all our brother's keepers. And if somebody in our particular group starts going off the rails, we need to go out and do something about that. You know, I look at it from the point of view of a Christian, because I'm a Christian, and one of the issues we've had is violence against abortion providers, okay? And so, I mean, if I saw somebody in the particular church I was in, it would sound like they were really kind of thinking about going in that direction, I'd pray a lot about it, okay? But I'd be looking for ways here to defuse the situation, or if necessarily, make a, you know, referral to law enforcement or whatever, okay? Because, you know, I mean, honestly, you know, this has been a fact throughout all the recorded history. Religion and violence, there's been some association with this, and it tends to be the more powerful the religious group becomes, the more violence you see. The first couple hundred years of Christianity, everybody was being pretty much persecuted, and there wasn't a problem, okay? When Constantine decided that the whole Roman Empire was suddenly going to become a Christian empire, things went downhill after that, okay? But we have a responsibility, and I think we have a bigger responsibility for the people who are closest to it, to make sure that they don't go in a wrong direction.
Mm-hmm. And one thing I want to add before we begin to close up here, is Walter Wink suggested that once you turn to violence, it's very hard to stop relying on violence. You think it's going to stop when you get in power, but it's very hard to turn violence off once you start it. So, Pastor Ronnie, tell us some things that are going on at the table.
Well, the table is in its, starting its third year as a community, faith community. We were formed to create an alternative kind of emergent-style ministry that would do things in a more creative way to engage young adults primarily is one of our goals, and also to reach out to marginalized communities, in particular the LGBTQ community. And so our worship is actually around tables, and much like we did right here, this would be our worship service. We sit at tables and talk. And this month on Thursday, the second Thursday of the month, we have Art Circle, and we do music and lots of art things. And the third Thursday of the month, we have Pub Theology, which is just this conversation more spirited. And, of course, Sunday worship's at 11 o'clock. And we're as pastor, I don't preach anymore. I facilitate conversation, which I think we got a taste of what that can be like here.
This has been Bible Study for Progressives. You can find us at metronation.blogspot.com. You can also find us on Stitcher, Podbean, Facebook, at meetup.com. Thank you, everybody. Enjoyed having everybody here.
Thank you.
And until next time, this is Rich Procida. Thank you for listening.